Good morning, everyone. And if you hear us and you hear maybe cups in the background or me slurping on something, it's because I'm sitting at the Friends of the Earth Cafe in
on Smith Street.
Yeah, on Smith Street. And it's because we have the Sustainability Breakfast Series all week this week. Hello, Molly.
Hi, Aishu.
How have you been?
I'm good.
Yeah, so we're excited. And sustainability means we're going to be talking about all sorts of things. So we've got water on today because we love water. Yeah, but we've got water on today because water is very crucial. And I think as much as, you know, Australia has enough and more water, it's definitely something we should be thinking about for our future generations.
On Wednesday, if you want to tune in, we're talking about energy, or not us, but the Wednesday breakfast team.
Yeah.
Thursday breakfast team is talking about food, and Friday is a general topic. So you should listen all week or come in at Friends of the Earth on Smith Street in Collingwood.
Yeah, and if you haven't mentioned it before, there's free food
coffee. There's free coffee.
If there's anything that should get you here, apart from the amazing topics we're going to be talking about, it is the free food and coffee.
Do you want to talk about who we're interviewing today, Aishu?
Yeah, maybe we'll just talk about who you're interviewing in a bit.
Oh, yeah.
Yummy! Here we are. What's on the menu today? Breakfast Friends of the Earth. Here, right now.
Yummy, 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 I got love in my tummy and chili and me.
Ah, great.
Yeah, so, right, so we've got a lot on the menu today, and let's get Michaela, who is a Friends of the Earth staff, to talk about it. Michaela, tell us, what are we eating?
So on the menu this morning, we've got potato rosti and oven roasted tomatoes. We have a tofu scramble and kale. So that's the hot breakfast. And then we've got our house-made muesli for people who prefer that with some organic fruits.
Yum. I'm definitely going to eat a rosti.
Yeah, I think I'm going to message my boss right now and tell her I'm going to be late because, I'm going to be eating it all. Yeah, that's delicious.
Thank you.
For anybody tuning in, it's on till 8:30. So please get here if you can. And we're gonna be eating a lot. And so please forgive the munching. But yeah, we've got a really packed show ahead. So at 7:15, we've got Sophie Christo from the Earthworker Cooperative, and we're going to be talking about water sustainability, what Earthworker does with regards to water, and how you can help in the future as well. At 7:30, we've got Anthony Amos. Anthony Amos is someone I think a lot of us have heard about because he's the president spokesperson of Friends of the Earth. And apart from that, he has done... hello, truck. Yeah, he has done some amazing work with regards to koalas and gumdrop plantations. He has done some other work with, chlorine in the water and how a lot of Melbourne drinking water is super affected by chlorine and how a lot of people don't even realize that it is. And also work on pesticides in the water. So yeah, that's going to be super interesting.
Cool. At around 7:55, I'm going to be speaking to Chloe Aldenhoven, who is an anti-coal and gas campaigner and coordinator of the Victorian Lock the Gate campaign and Quit Coal. So we're going to be talking about coal seam gas, fracking, and if you're wondering what that has to do with water, well, you should listen to my interview.
Yeah, definitely. And yeah, that's our fun show for today. So let's get cracking.
The front page, where 3CR Breakfast explores what's being reported and what's not in Australia's mainstream media. How the media prioritise the day's news, including issues of bias, corporate influence, and who gets a voice and who doesn't. Monday to Friday at 7 a.m. and again at 8 a.m. A critical analysis of the nation's newspapers.
Right, we're back on the front page, and Molly, do you want to go ahead?
I'm looking at page 12 of The Age. There's a two-page spread about youth mental health, which I think is worth talking about. The article on the far left is by Catherine Armitage. She says, the treatment given to young people who self-harm in emergency departments is so damaging and discriminatory that it would not be tolerated in any other medical setting, says the first national report on this largely hidden and misunderstood behaviour.
Mm.
So it says almost a quarter of young women and a fifth of young men aged 20 to 24 years old have self-harmed. And a 2010 survey of 12,000 Australians published in the Medical Journal of Australia found those statistics, yet half of them do not seek help due to stigma and lack of community understanding, says the new report from Origin, the National Centre of Excellence in Youth Mental Health. It also says once people have experienced such negative and damaging responses from medical professionals, they're unlikely to seek out support a second time. They're accused of just attention-seeking. The not-for-profit organisation Origin partnered with the Colonial Foundation, the University of Melbourne, and Melbourne Health. It claims to be the world's leading research organisation in mental ill health among youth. It's an interesting article. I think that this is probably something that people should be talking about more, about the medical industry and how it treats mental health and how it treats mental health patients, especially for young people, considering that rates of self-harm and rates of debilitating mental health are so high. I'll just read out a couple of helplines in case you're listening and want to talk to somebody. You can call Lifeline on 131114, or there's also a kids helpline of 1-800-55-1800.
I think it's very crucial to know that the medical industry should have no judgment, but but it's also pretty difficult.
It's unsurprised. Like I'm unsurprised.
Really?
But by that report.
I'm a little surprised. I always thought maybe the medical professionals are a little more understanding towards situations like that, but I've read a very different article. I'm reading The Guardian online, and this is an article that's close to the sustainability series. It says the staff demand ANU finish divestment from fossil fuels. So academics and general staff commend universities for withstanding public criticism over initial divestment and call for future for further share sales. In case you've been keeping track on this, ANU Canberra has, in 2014, under the previous Vice Chancellor, divested from 7 resource companies, selling about 16 million worth of shares. First of all, hats off to do something like that. And trust Joe Hockey, who definitely has to weigh in on everything, who said, oh my God, ANU is removed from reality of what is helping drive the Australian economy and to create more employment. I think what Joe Hockey should actually have been saying is, ANU is giving the Australian government an opportunity to start funding and, focusing more on, renewable energy than on fossil fuels. But, there's a new letter that's signed by 450 teachers, staff, and general staff that commends the university for withstanding all the pressure, and this is including a lot of, people, just normal people and students, parents who've been giving the university a lot of feedback, or at least bad feedback on this. And the spokesperson for 350.org, who helped organize the open letter, said it's the second largest such letter in the world. So after the University of California, which led, ANU was really inspired and decided to start divesting in a lot of companies. And then he said, this is really nice. The vice chancellor said, we need to be able to put our hand on our heart when we talk to our students and to our alumni and to our researchers and be able to say that we're confident that the sort of companies we're investing in are consistent with the broad themes that drive this university. So, yeah, that's a pretty interesting article.
Yeah, I guess my concern with those things is issues of greenwashing of those companies and how that industry then works. It's also funny, The Guardian has published 3 articles on that one opinion piece, and then one article simply titled ANU Fossil Fuel Divestment Decision Stupid, Tony Abbott Says, which I think is funny.
Yeah.
Just because it puts stupid and Tony Abbott in the one line together.
Where else would it be? Stupid and Tony Abbott have to be in one line. Yeah, but I still think it's important because, I mean, the Guardian's giving us all different points of view. I agree with greenwashing, but it's better to have less fossil fuel companies with some greenwashing than have a bazillion fossil fuel companies.
Yeah, I'm looking at page 8 of The Age, and there's an article called Indonesia Appeals to Australia to Accept More Refugees. So Indonesia has appealed to Australia to accept more refugees stranded in Indonesia ahead of a regional forum to combat people smuggling in Bali next week. Indonesia's Director General of Immigration, Ronnie Sombi, told the Jakarta Post that Indonesia's 13 immigration detention centres were overcrowded as the number of, in quotation marks, illegal migrants had increased more than fivefold over the past 7 years. The UN's refugee agency, the UNHCR, has also called on Australia to lift its ban on accepting refugees who arrived in Indonesia after June 2014, saying that the global refugee crisis was making it increasingly difficult to find resettlement countries. We hope Australia will consider increasing its take of refugees, although we know they will apply a very selective process before accepting them, he said. Obviously, the global refugee crisis is only going to be made, is already being made even worse by environmental impact of, So I feel like this is yet another article in the news that's quoting the UN telling Australia to lift its game, and Australia is clapping its ears. There was another article, actually, that I read over the weekend in the Saturday paper. They published an opinion piece by an asylum seeker who had spent a couple of years in, I think, in Nauru, and it was a really great article, and I believe the name was a pseudonym, I can't recall the pseudonym, and I don't know who wrote it, but it was a really good piece, and I thought it was pretty brave of them to publish it, and brave of him to write it, and you should go check it out. It was published on Saturday paper.
Also, for everybody just tuning in, we are doing a sustainability breakfast series, and it's happening all week from the Friends of the Earth Food Co-op, and that's on Smith Street. You can't miss it. Also, if you're on Twitter, and if you're a Twitterer, is it Twitterer or is it Tweeple? I can't, anyway.
Tweeter?
Tweeter? Yeah, maybe. So if you're a Tweeter or a Facebooker, please get to the 3CR page. We're at 3CR on Twitter and on Facebook. You'll find us with a loud, unabashed, and very spunky page. You can't miss us. And
you can watch us.
Oh,
drink our tea.
Yeah.
And talk into the microphone, which we usually do in the privacy of the 3CR studios.
Yeah. Maybe
you can see the sleep in my eye this morning.
I think they hear it enough. But yeah, if you're on Twitter or Facebook, give us a shout out, and we'd love to retweet you, talk to you, and start having a conversation, because sustainability is something we would definitely like to talk about. Oh, yeah, sorry. I didn't even realize we were back on. I was too busy sipping my hot chocolate. Anyway, so we're going to do an interview with Sophie. Sophie is from the Earth Worker Cooperative. Hello, Sophie. Good morning.
Good morning.
Are you enjoying this lovely atmosphere and our wonderful company?
Most certainly, yeah. It's always so beautiful to come down for these sustainable breakfasts. So, yeah, Poe is a lovely host for us.
Yeah, definitely. And again, repeating that Poe's got free food and free coffee, so you should be here. Anyway, so I'm going to jump right in. Can you please tell our listeners what the Earth Worker Co-op is about?
Yeah, definitely. So Earth Worker is a community-led and run organization, and we're about establishing worker-owned cooperatives in sustainable industries, not specifically in Melbourne or in cities, but right across the country.
Okay. And with regards to Earth Worker, I follow you guys and know some of the things you do, but
What are the partnerships that you've had in, earlier in the past? Just to give us an idea of, you know, when you say sustainability or community-led sustainability, how does it work? Are you only talking about employment, or are you talking about cleaner energy?
Okay, so our approach is that there's the possibility and legitimate, meaningful, dignified work in sustainable industries, in green jobs. And so our biggest project to date has been the establishment of the Eureka's Future Worker Cooperative,
mm-hmm.
which is manufacturing high-quality solar hot water systems that can be installed in all properties, rental properties, in houses that people might own. So that's just in a temporary standstill, just while we work out some administration stuff. But yeah. We have established and installed many, many hot water systems into homes.
Okay, so I know like the hot water. Oh, sorry. I know the hot water systems are currently on a standstill because of a lot of, you know, administrative issues, and plus it gets very difficult to because of the increasing number of hot water systems. But can you just give us a brief on how this hot water system was different and why more people should definitely be looking into it once the matter gets resolved?
Yeah. So these systems are manufactured in a Walker cooperative in Dandenong.
Okay.
So the people who manufacture these systems are also the owners of that business. So they have a social investment into that business and into the community, which doesn't occur in the majority of businesses and within our current economic system. So they have an incentive to be building something that will last. So over time, you're going to be using less resources because you are building, and our communities are purchasing hot water systems that they won't need to replace. Mm-hmm. They have a lifetime warranty on them. And these are creating jobs that are outside of the traditional economy. In industries and being compatible to solar hot water systems, so systems that people have on their homes, mm-hmm. or highly efficient heat pumps, which are significantly less energy intensive than a gas heating or a traditional electric heating hot water system. We're also helping save and reduce the use of resources in heating our water in our homes.
Yeah,
and we're working on getting some government procurement options so that we have bulk purchases of these systems to help get the co-op back into its running.
Definitely, yeah. Let's fingers crossed on this government, but yeah, okay. So how does Earthworker feel about water sustainability, just on the whole? I mean, I know you're doing a lot with solar water heating, and that itself is one big aspect of water sustainability, but as a co-op, and I'm sure you see a lot of people who come in from different walks of life, but let's talk about environment sustainability first, and then water sustainability.
Yeah, totally. So the beauty of Earthworker Cooperative is that we're a large umbrella. We're a welcome house to many different and diverse groups and interests. So our Earthworker ecosystem, as some of our other organisers like to refer to it, includes quite a diverse range of cooperatives that are being established. And one of those is a farming cooperative called Hedgerow Farm that one of our members is setting up near Dalesford in central Victoria. Mm-hmm. And so this co-op farm is giving access to land for small-scale farmers on a long-term basis, so they can invest in creating a farming enterprise there. And the biggest tenant of this cooperative farm will be a fish farm, but specifically it will be aquaponics. So I don't know if everyone's familiar, but aquaponics is a combination of aquaculture, so fish farming, and growing agriculture, so growing land crops. So this is an incredibly water efficient and drought proof way of farming and growing food for people, in that you're using one unit of water to both grow fish and so grow that protein, and also grow lettuce crops and salad and vegetables using the one batch of water, and doing that in a chemical free way, because the nutrients that the fish leave in the water irrigate and fertilize simultaneously there.
That's amazing. So apart from when you talk about aquaponics, and first of all, aquaponics is so interesting. If anybody has ever seen it
you know, take form. It's lovely. I saw it on a school excursion.
It was really educating
more than anything else.
Yeah.
But with the Earthwork Co-op, like you're talking about water sustainability and how they're helping in so many ways. So is there a way people can help? Like, can people join or become part of the co-op or give, like make their company, industry a part of the co-op?
So the requirements for being a cooperative as a basis are that you need to have five worker owners.
Mm-hmm.
And so if someone is in a business or is has a traditional business that they are interested in transitioning to a cooperative, we can certainly have a chat with them and direct them to other people within our network who can support in that transition to worker ownership. But within Earthworker ourselves, we're always happy and keen to have the support of new people. If people are interested in cooperatives and wanting to know more, and we do have a very wide network of friends and comrades across the world. Actually, we've had cooperatives from Earthworker go to Mondragon in Spain, which is it's almost a city that's established around cooperatives of all different types. So the whole economy of this region is based in worker cooperatives. But back to home, we are always on the lookout for volunteers to come and help us out in specific roles and using the skills that they have to support our work.
Mm-hmm.
If people are interested in the solar hot water systems, they can go to our website, which is earthworkercooperative.com.au, and they can make a down payment for a hot water system.
Mm-hmm.
They can also become a member, and like most community organisations, like those little drops of cash monies that membership providers do generally help us in our day-to-day running of and supporting us in our daily activities. So people can become members on our website also.
That's fantastic. Okay, so this is I think this is a question directed to you, but you know, I meet a lot of people, and when I speak about water sustainability, I'm from India, and so you know, we in India, because we have so many people, water sustainability is something we're constantly thinking about. So you know, we're definitely thinking about things like rainwater harvesting. We're looking at things like collection of water, especially like in a community, like, you know, getting water and reducing the intake of water. So, you know, it's only 3 hours of water a day or 4 hours of water a day, and collecting it. So just so you know how frugal you have to be with it. But now Australia doesn't have an issue with water yet, but do you think you're heading in a direction where maybe at some point there will definitely be an effect where you'll have to start looking at water sustainability more crucially?
Definitely, without a doubt. Like, we're living in a world of climate change. So the decade-long drought that happened in the beginning of the 2000s, that is a very clear result of climate change, and changing weather patterns in Australia make major problems for our agricultural industries and the security that farmers have to grow food for people to eat. And that's why operations like this aquaponic system at Hedgerow Farm are so exciting, because they're creating they're innovative ways of creating food and growing food for people that aren't relying on the traditional huge amounts of water, and doing it in a much more efficient way. And I think more generally, like, environmental sustainability and water sustainability is inextricably linked to social justice, and so if we're going to have a sustainable environment and ecosystems which are healthy, and healthy landscapes and a safe climate, we can't do that at the expense of communities and livelihoods. And so a really strong, or the strong foundation of Earthworker, and something that we always return to, is that we're about creating meaningful, dignified work that is within the green, future, sustainable industry, rather than communities having to rely on having work from extractive industries or unsustainable bases. So one of our projects with our solar hot water manufacturing mm-hmm. is establishing a cooperative in Morwell, which is in the Latrobe Valley, mm-hmm. which is where one of the major employers is the coal industry. Yeah. So we're trying to create jobs meaningfully that will help maintain communities.
Yeah. I know, especially in the Latrobe Valley, there's so much with regards to poisoning and there are more medical issues because of all the coal and all the gas and all of that. And so I think this is a great way of getting more and more people to choose the right side, which is the green way to go, and it's definitely a sustainable method. Is there anything else you would like to say to our listeners before we head off to drink our coffee again?
Have another sip.
Yeah.
I just mentioned over the summer break we ran a really successful crowdfunding campaign called Give Tanks.
Ooh.
And so we raised almost $25,000 in that crowdfunding, which is pretty nifty over the summer break when everyone's spending their money on holiday booze and Christmas feasts and going and travelling to visit family and friends and stuff. So we were really happy and grateful to our community for that. And so the hot water systems that we were funding for there are to install into low-income households that are managed by Aboriginal Housing Victoria. And so that crowdfund and that is a really important, I guess, expression for Earthworker of another thing that is passionate about us, like within all of this, is that we're working in solidarity with Indigenous communities and allowing them to live out their futures and act autonomously and providing kind of the support that we can in practical, tangible ways. So being able to give appropriate technology for the Aboriginal Housing Victoria kind of housing stock is a way that we see we can do this, and we're really proud of that partnership.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And for anybody who wants to go online or is on Twitter right now, is there an Earthworker handle and a 3CR handle? So it's at 3CR. What is the Earthworker handle?
I'm not sure whether it's Twitterers or Tweeters either.
Yeah, I think it's Tweeple. No, people who are on Twitter are called Tweeples.
Okay. So the tweeps out there, they can find us at Earthworker Coop.
Okay.
So cooperative without the hyphen.
Yeah.
So Earthworker Coop on Twitter, and on Facebook we're Earthworker Coop also.
Yeah.
And our website again is earthworkercooperative.com.au.
Fantastic. So for anybody tuning in, we just spoke to Sophie Christo. Sophie is from the Earthworker Co-op. We spoke about everything from solar hot water, the systems that they have in place, and the number of jobs they have given because of these this factory that creates solar hot water. And we spoke about water sustainability, and if you want to know more about aquaponics, it's something you should definitely read up on. It's extremely interesting, and the amount of, the benefit to not just farmers and small communities, but to everyone is fantastic. You should definitely read on aquaponics and check out the Earthworker website. They've got so much stuff, and they're changing the world one little step at a time. So let's do it. Let's join them. And
can I just add one more thing on the aquaponics?
Please.
If people are interested in learning more about this particular system or this cooperative farm that's being set up in Central Victoria, the website for that is hedgerowfarm.com.au as well.
There you go. Can you spell it out just for a listener?
Yeah, hedgerow, so H-E-D-G-E-R-O-W, farm, F-A-R-M, .com.au.
Fantastic. Now you know exactly where to go. Aquaponics is the way.
3CR Breakfast would like to say thank you to program sponsor The New International Bookshop for the financial support of this program. You can find The New International Bookshop in the basement of Trades Hall at 54 Victoria Street, Carlton.
Okay, so we are back, and I've just had enough hot chocolate, I think, for about 20 days. We're here with Anthony Amos. I don't think Anthony really needs an introduction because he's pretty well known, especially in the environment circles. But hello, Anthony. Good morning.
Yeah, hi.
So we're going to be talking about two things today. We're going to start with koalas and the gumdrop plantations, and then we're going to move, because we're talking about water sustainability, I'd definitely like to talk about the report that you did on chlorine in the water, just to talk about how it is affecting a lot of Melbournians and why it's so important to know where your drinking water comes from. So let's just jump right in. And so would you like to start with how a lot of koalas are getting affected by gum, like because of the deforestation, and how it's leading to other things?
Our project is concentrating down in the Gippsland region.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people don't realise that by about the 1920s, koalas throughout Victoria and South Australia were largely extinct.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a survey done by the Forest Service back in about 1920, and they found the only remaining population was around the Yarrama region.
Okay.
So they'd been wiped out across much of Victoria. But what had happened in the 1890s was that a farmer from the South Gippsland region took about five koalas over to French Island as a present to his a woman he was interested in. Anyway, those animals, they bred up quite quickly.
Okay.
And they started to eat out all the habitat of manna gum on French Island.
Okay.
And then what happened was the government people then had to move the animals on to other islands,
mm-hmm.
Such as Phillip Island and Snake Island, etc. And they started eating out all the habitat there as well.
Okay.
And so as a result of this over-browsing population, the government then embarked on a translocation program and moved the koalas from those islands all around Victoria, essentially, and into
mm-hmm.
South Australia.
Mm-hmm.
And so those animals are largely inbred.
Mm-hmm.
But the ones in Gippsland aren't, because they are the original gene pool.
Okay.
And they're genetically robust, whereas all the other animals across Victoria and South Australia aren't. And so because of the significance of the koala in that region, we've embarked on a koala mapping project.
Okay.
And it was initially kicked off in 2013 by the Park Service from New South Wales, who came down and did some surveys. They were interested in getting some animals from Victoria to take into New South Wales, because the populations of koalas in New South Wales had crashed.
On
the south coast of New South Wales, there's about 20 koalas left.
I'm going to ask, I have like three questions I already have. One is, in the 1800s, how did koalas become extinct?
They were largely hunted.
Why do people hunt koalas?
Well, there was a massive market in koala skins. Across the world, and it wasn't until about the 1930s that the Roosevelt government in the US put a ban to the importation of koala skins, and the trade was stopped.
Okay, but now there's no koala skins at all that's sold. But okay, second question, how did? Sorry about that. That's the crazy cars. So now New South Wales has 20 koalas. What happened?
That's in the south of New South Wales.
Mm-hmm.
And there's in New South Wales and Queensland, the animals are now listed as endangered under the Federal Act, but that's not the case in Victoria.
Okay.
And the other complicating factor is that the animals that were sent around Victoria and South Australia, If they came from the French Island population, they weren't exposed to a disease which keeps the numbers low in the wild, which is called chlamydia.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happens is, if you release these animals into the areas in other areas of the state without this disease in the population, you get a massive overbrowsing population, and that's happened in southwestern Victoria mm-hmm. and in some places in South Australia as well. And there was actually an event of about 18 months ago where the state government of Victoria had to cull about 600 koalas by lethal injection down at Cape Otway because they were knocking out the Manigum forest down there.
Okay, so that's my next question. How do koalas affect the gum plantations?
Well, down in the southwest, mm-hmm. There was a massive blue gums planted. This mm-hmm. is about 15 years ago.
Okay.
And koalas like blue gums. Okay. And so as this new habitat was planted, the animals moved into the plantations.
Okay.
And without this this disease, chlamydia, the populations can double in a very short amount of time.
All right.
And so as the plantations are due to be logged after mm-hmm. 10 or 15 years, the company moves in and lo and behold, they've got a high population of koalas inside the plantation. So, and the dangers there is the animals are killed and injured when the logging occurs.
Okay. So this is just my understanding of it. But say you have like the company who's... Why were they planting blue gums in the first place?
Well, there was a push from the federal government okay. to significantly increase the amount of trees in the ground.
All right.
And they allowed tax incentives for naive investors.
Okay.
And so there was hundreds of millions of dollars pumped into this industry, and there were trees planted all over the landscape, particularly in southwestern Victoria, and in sites that weren't entirely appropriate. So there's that issue. There's a massive increase in trees down there, and and with that came the increase of koala population. So it's a big headache down in the southwest.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, that's another issue that we were looking at last year. But our main emphasis at the moment is in the Strzelecki's and the South mm-hmm. Gippsland region, where we're doing we go into sites and assess populations of the animals.
Mm-hmm.
We don't look in the trees; we look on the ground. So we look for scats.
Okay.
And then at each of these sites, we do a 30 tree circle.
All right.
And then from that, we work out the amount of scats in the circle. And then from that, you get you add that into a computer program, and you can get a population density across the landscape.
Okay.
And the other thing we wanted to do was to work out what are the preferred trees that the koalas eat. So there's some results in the Strzelecki's, which are a little bit different. So they like the blue gums, of course, but the mountain grey gum is a tree that they're are very fond of in that region.
Okay.
So there's about 15 eucalypts that they'll eat.
Oh.
But they prioritise down in the Strzelecki's anyway, a mountain grey gum and blue gum.
Okay.
Yellow stringy bark is another one. So, depending where you are and what trees are growing, that will determine the koalas. The other interesting thing with koala is the soil nutrients. If you're on poor soils...
Mm-hmm.
You won't get the numbers even if you have the trees.
So this is just me assuming that New South Wales and South Australia don't have as good soil as Victoria does, they don't have as many numbers.
Well, you know, like I said, there's only 20 koalas left in the south of New South Wales, which mm-hmm. is appalling. I'm not too sure why that situation's arisen, but I've got a feeling it probably be associated with the intensive wood chipping happening in that region since the 70s.
Okay. But it's good to know that Victoria have as much wood chipping, which is another issue with sustainability. What happens to these koalas, say, there's an entire stretch of land by an investor that's just, cut off and there's... And like they deforest an entire area, what happens to the koalas? Do the koalas, I'm assuming a lot of them die?
Well, it's basically hit and miss, the animals, really.
Okay.
If they survive the logging, they've got to find other habitat.
Oh,
and
right.
Part of the problem in the southwest region where all these blue gums were put in, there's not enough sort of neighbouring habitat, so the animals move out into the landscape and... and then they're prone to all sorts of problems.
Okay. So how can our listeners help with the
Well, look, the main thing we're after really is small donations, just getting the word out. What we're trying to do at the moment is get in touch with landowners in the Strzelecki's and particularly South Gippsland region. So we've made this poster up, which I've got in front of me, and that's been distributed across the region. So we're just getting in touch with landowners that have access to a fair bit of bush on their properties.
Okay.
And I was down at a place called Middle Tarwin yesterday and working with a landowner down there, assessing his property for koalas, and he was happy to hear that he had a population there, which he was very happy about.
Mm-hmm. That was my other question, that are Victorian landowners okay with the idea that there are lots of koalas on their land? Is that all right, or does it affect them that maybe the koalas are eating the gum trees, gum leaves, or are they completely fine with it? Because I know like they cull kangaroos and things, but
yeah,
they have an issue with koalas?
Well, depending where they are, but most landholders that we see are pretty happy to have them.
Yeah, okay.
And know that they're there, and yeah, it's sort of it gives them a reason for living, I suppose.
Yeah, but I feel, you know, this is just me, but you know, when you're driving across even your Great Ocean Road, you see so many koalas, it really doesn't occur to someone like me that there might be an issue, and there might be you know, like the koala population in certain states might be dropping, because in Victoria there seem to be millions.
Yeah, well, the populations are, well, they regard them as secure in Victoria and South Australia. And that's what I mentioned before, but largely because of the translocation program.
Yeah.
And you've got this problem of overbrowsing and animals that, you know, have a high density in some of these areas where they've moved into. But in the Strzelecki's, the endemic population, we're looking at possibly around 2,000 animals.
Okay.
So it's definitely not millions.
Mm. Yeah. So I'm just going to jump into the other report of yours. It's about water sustainability, and considering our show is on water sustainability, I want to talk about chlorine levels in the water. And the report you did spoke about specific areas, I think like coves and other areas in Melbourne, in Victoria, which were affected by chlorine. And can you just tell us a little more about that?
Well, it's a complicated story in itself. Look, chlorine is used as a disinfectant in water, which has probably saved millions and millions of lives. Mm-hmm. I mean, look, across the world up to before the 1920s, there was a massive outbreaks of waterborne disease such as cholera.
Mm-hmm.
And so chlorine has potentially saved millions of lives. So we're not sort of concerned so much about chlorine, but what they found in the 1970s, there was a scientist in Holland, I think, and what he found was when you mix chlorine with water, it can react with the organic molecules in the water, and it creates what are called disinfection byproducts.
Okay.
So in the 1974, this particular guy found that if you treat water with chlorine, he got a byproduct called chloroform.
Yeah.
Now, since that time, they've found about 700 to 800 different disinfection byproducts.
Okay.
That are formed from chlorine and organic molecules in the source water. Now, depending where you are and where you live, you can get very high levels of these disinfection byproducts, and a lot of them have been linked with cancer, particularly bladder cancer. And so we did a few surveys around Victoria and found that there was a number of particularly smaller communities where the levels of disinfection byproducts were very high. And we focused, there was an area around Phillip Island, down in the southeast of the state, which for years, some of the towns down there were drinking one of the disinfection byproducts, which was called bromodichloromethane. They were drinking that at levels much higher than what would be recommended as safe by the World Health Organization.
Okay.
We've also done studies in South Australia and found that, for instance, the city of Adelaide, there's a lot of residents there that are drinking this same substance and have been for decades above the World Health Organization standards. In Melbourne, the issue isn't as bad. So what happens, particularly, this has got impacts in times of climate change.
Mm-hmm.
As reservoir levels drop and the water becomes more saline, mm-hmm. if you treat that with chlorine, you're going to get a higher potential to create these byproducts. So if you're in a small town with a water supply which is vulnerable, you're looking at much greater odds of having these substances. The other thing I should point out is that the safe guideline in Australia is three times higher than the equivalent guideline in the United States.
Why is that?
Well, the water authorities are totally paranoid that if they reduce the disinfection level, that they'll get an outbreak of waterborne disease, and that's a fair call.
Okay.
But at the same time, the US has managed to lower their guidelines, and we're sort of urging that to happen in Australia mm-hmm. as well. There was a few towns in Western Victoria that were having very high levels, mm-hmm. particularly.
Okay.
And my concern is if we enter another period of low rainfall and low reservoir levels, you're going to get problems across Australia. In Victoria, the levels are monitored and are published every year, but in other states, such as New South Wales and Queensland, the responsibility for drinking water is local councils.
Okay.
And we think a lot of residents, particularly in those arid areas, aren't being informed of these issues. And, you know, if you talk to anyone in the street, how many people have heard about disinfection byproducts?
Yeah.
No one. And you breathe them in the shower, yes. Or when you swim, there's byproducts formed, so you're exposed all the time. So
yeah. So with regards to like the Phillip Island and everything, after you inform them that, you know, they've got really high levels of the byproduct, have there been any changes with the water authorities there?
What they sometimes do is they add ammonia to the treatment process,
okay.
and that lowers the one particular class of byproducts, but it creates okay. others.
Oh God!
And so they did get a lower amounts of what was the main problem, bromodichloromethane, but mm-hmm. they've started getting other byproducts. Some are more toxic.
Okay, so how would you, like, is there a solution to this problem?
Well, the solution is, I mean, there's a whole range of other water treatment processes that are available, but the problem is we're on this chlorine ideology, and it's, mm-hmm. that's been the case for 80 years, and it's going to cost billions of dollars to refit the water treatment plants to accept other forms of treatment. Mm-hmm. So, yes, it's a big problem. In the US, the water authorities are tackling this issue. And in Australia, we're trying to get the regulators to lower the safe guideline level, but we're meeting a lot of resistance.
Okay, so this is regulators at even council level?
Well, the guidelines set by the National Health and Medical Research Council, and they haven't looked at this level since the mid-90s.
But isn't it surprising that, you know, especially with, like, the environment changing, with global warming, with all of these issues, you would think authorities like that would be constantly on their feet and constantly changing how they tackle, you know, certain things, but it's clearly not the case.
Yeah, well, look, the entire water industry, it's a rule to itself. And, you know, how many people know exactly what's coming down out of their taps? I'll guarantee hardly anyone even thinks about it or knows where to go for information.
Absolutely.
So, you know, you're drinking it every day, you're showering in it, you're bathing in it. The other issue is, just quickly, is when the water industry test for drinking water, what they usually do is they flush out your taps for 2 or 3 minutes.
Okay.
And then they take the sample.
Oh.
But if you're in a house and you make a cup of tea in the morning, there's no way you're gonna do that. So what happens is overnight there's a build-up of stuff in the taps, and that comes out first thing in the morning, of course. Yeah, but look, it's a huge issue. In Tasmania last year, we did a report. There was some small communities there with massive problems with lead.
Okay.
In their drinking water. Lead is often from old plumbing fixtures and the lead residues. If there's a high acidity in the water, they'll corrode and end up in the water as well. So, you know, there's a thousand issues there, which are worth thinking about.
Yeah. So, just wrapping up, what is the one thing you'll definitely tell our listeners, and where can they go to learn more about, you know, what they're drinking and how they're using their water?
Well, if you're interested in this, if you go to the Friends of the Earth website, go to campaigns, and you go to either the toxics section of the FOA website, or there's a section called water.
Okay.
And a number of the reports are on there, and including probably towns where people, your listeners are living. There's a few communities there that we've done reports on.
Okay, that's fantastic. So for anybody tuning in, that was Anthony Amos speaking to us both about the koalas and gumdrop plantations in Victoria, New South Wales and South Australia, and about chlorine in water, which is extremely crucial to all of us. So next time you open your taps early in the morning, make sure you let some water go before you decide to make your tea. Thank you, Anthony. That was a wonderful interview.
Just for anyone who's listening to Tuesday Breakfast this morning and doesn't know, we're live from Friends of the Earth on Smith Street in Collingwood for the annual Sustainable Breakfast Series, where all week we are talking about sustainability and getting free breakfast and coffee at the same time, which is great, from the awesome people down here. You should come in. We're on Smith Street, if you didn't know. Our theme today is about water. I'm speaking with Chloe Aldenhoven, who is an anti-coal and gas campaigner and coordinator of the Victorian Lock the Gate campaign, also Quit Coal. We're going to be talking about coal seam gas. Hi, Chloe.
Hi, Molly. How are you going?
Good. How are you?
Yeah, good.
Happy to be here in the studio. In the
bright and early.
I know a little bit about how water is used in the fracking process, but for anyone listening who doesn't understand what coal seam gas is, or how that could be related to the topic of water, could you enlighten us?
Sure. So coal seam gas is one kind of unconventional gas, and unconventional gases are gases that are trapped in various geological formations that were too difficult to get to before with traditional gas mining techniques. So they developed new techniques for extracting gas. And there are various concerns that people have over the unconventional gas extraction and the effects that it has on water. With coal seam gas, the gas is trapped in a coal seam under a heap of water. And in order to extract that gas, they actually remove heaps of water out of a coal seam to relieve the pressure, and then that brings up a whole heap of gas that was previously unavailable. So with the coal seam gas extraction process, there's a huge amount of water that's removed from that water system. As a result, the adjacent aquifers move around to try and compensate, and that means that a whole heap of freshwater aquifers can then move into a coal seam, which is full of all kinds of heavy metals and dangerous chemicals, and that freshwater is then contaminated. We've found in Queensland, in a lot of places, farmers around gas fields, coal seam gas fields, have had a whole heap of water removed from their bore systems, which has meant that they're not able to farm the way that they used to. A whole heap of water been taken out of that system. And it's been a huge burden on the water systems there. The other part of the unconventional gas extraction process that is most famous is fracking. And fracking involves basically pumping a whole heap of water, sand and chemicals at very high pressure underground to crack the rock. So this often means sourcing water from other places, whether it's town water supplies, whether it's underground water systems, huge volumes of water to do this high volume, high pressure fracturing. And the other problem that people are having is that the fracking process itself, both the pressure and the way that the wells are constructed, means that aquifers can suddenly interact, whereas before there was no pathway for them to interact. So a saline aquifer might suddenly find a pathway to a freshwater aquifer and contaminate it. Chemicals that are used in the fracking process, and a lot of them are very toxic, can sometimes leak into water systems underground. Toxic chemicals that naturally exist in geological formations but are separated from freshwater aquifers by geological layers suddenly have pathways for contamination as well. So it's just completely disrupting these very delicate and complex underground water systems. And, farmers and residents and people all over the place are saying, wait a minute, we're going to have to stop this until we've done assessment of the kind of effects that it's having on water, because water is so precious to us on the driest continent on Earth.
Yeah. There's a few words in the debate about coal seam gas. You've used a few of them in your explanation, which is great. And I think it can be kind of confusing for people reading the media. I sometimes think that these things are a matter of marketing. You know, some people use the word fracking, some people are talking about coal seam gas, unconventional gas. For people reading the news, are there differences in these terms? I gather from your explanation that definitely there is, but do you see a way that it's used in the media? Obviously, fracking has a dirty name, and I don't think... coal and gas companies want people to be using that name.
Mm.
What's your views on that?
Yeah, I mean, fracking was an interesting choice by the oil and gas industry, because obviously it has a very harsh sound to it.
Yeah,
and it definitely pricks people's ears up and makes people say, wait a minute, that doesn't sound so good. I'm not really sure that I would let you frack my water systems. But we tend to not use fracking so much, because fracking is just one of the techniques that's involved in unconventional gas extraction. And the important... We actually like to use the term unconventional gas because it covers coal seam gas, shale gas and tight gas. CSG or coal seam gas has got a big name in Australia because it's what they started with. In Queensland and New South Wales, they've started extracting coal seam gas first. But actually, probably the majority of licences in Australia are for shale gas and tight gas. 90% of the Northern Territory at the moment is covered in exploration licences for shale gas.
Mm.
And the companies like to say, oh, yeah, I know there's a lot of opposition to that coal seam gas stuff up north, but we're not doing coal seam gas here. We're doing shale gas or tight gas, so everything's going to be okay.
Yeah.
So we like to use the terms unconventional gas or unconventional gas fields or invasive gas fields, because unlike conventional gas, it's just not one or two wells to extract a commercial amount of gas. They need hundreds, if not thousands, of wells dotting the landscape every 500 metres to a kilometre in order to extract gas. So it creates the kind of grid pattern that you might have seen in pictures. And it's important to remember that this is an industrialisation of vast parts of our landscape that they're talking about. 87% of Gippsland is covered in exploration licences, a million hectares in Western Victoria. These are huge stretches of our agricultural land, of our rural landscapes, places where a lot of people live, that they're trying to put these masses of infrastructure, hundreds of if not thousands of wells, pipelines, compressor stations... full petrochemical infrastructure.
Yeah, as far as I know, in Victoria, it's a bit up in the air what will happen in the future, but a Victorian parliamentary inquiry found that more research is needed before any decisions are made on the future of the industry. Do you see this as a win for the campaign, or is this uncertainty still a concern? Do you think that a ban will happen eventually?
Elsewhere? We've been very very lucky / well organised in Victoria. We kind of saw what was happening in Queensland and America, and started to see the complaints that communities were having with water contamination, with people's health. And in New South Wales, they managed to come up with some very clever community-based strategies for stopping gas fields and stopping gas companies from getting access to areas. We started using them. It's called the Gasfield Free Community Process, or the Mining Free Communities Process, where communities do a democratic grassroots survey. They ask every single person in the community if they want to declare themselves gasfield free and inform people of their right to refuse to negotiate with gas companies. And we started to have the same kind of amazing results that they've had in New South Wales, where an average of over 95% of the community say that they don't want this industry to take hold in their community. And the the network of gas field free communities that developed managed to get a moratorium put in place in Victoria, and we've managed to keep that moratorium in place. Every time the government, you know, stretches it out for another year, they expect that the community opposition is going to die down. Yeah. But every time they extend it, the community opposition and the community movement actually grows.
Yeah.
So the government at the moment have to respond to that inquiry. They have to decide whether or not they're going to lift the moratorium or extend it or change it in some way, or maybe even put in place a total ban, which is what the communities are asking for.
Yeah.
And so we're expecting an announcement on that any time now, really any time from between now and June. So we're really encouraging people to get in contact with the Premier, with the Deputy Premier, with the Treasurer, and let them know that our agricultural industries, our tourism industries, our rural landscapes and the things that we hold precious in rural Victoria are too great to risk for an unconventional gas industry. Because we are hoping that the Andrews government are going to step up to the plate and put in place a ban.
Yeah.
The Auditor General said that the Victorian regulatory system is just not ready for an unconventional gas industry, that there are big questions about the risks. I think that the community's voice and the community's perspective is starting to be heard.
Yeah. The campaign against coal seam gas seems to be a really great example of the power of community organising and coordination and strategic activism across different areas of regional Victoria, but also between states. You talked a little bit about that already, but I was wondering if you could expand on the strategies of the campaign.
I think it's been an absolutely amazing campaign. I know the stories they tell in New South Wales about the fear that people had. So the gasfield-free communities process, the way it started was there was a lot of concern about what was happening in Queensland. People in the Northern Rivers of New South Wales realised that people were starting to get a knock on the door by these gas companies and asking for access. And there was a lot of kind of fear and uncertainty in the community. And they held a community meeting where they kind of talked about the problems with unconventional gas and asked everybody in the crowds who would want to declare this area gas field free or roads and lands gas field free. And before that, there's a lot of uncertainty in the community about, you know, perhaps my neighbour, you know, is interested in the compensation agreements involved. Perhaps they think they can make a bit of money out of it. Am I the only person who's worried about the health effects and the environmental effects? But when they asked that question, do you want to declare your roads and lands gas field free, every single person in the hall put up their hand. And it was a very profound moment of community consensus, because they realised that everybody around me cares as much as I do, is as worried about as I am about the things that we could lose. And they started working together. They said, well, you know, not everyone's here, we've got to go out and survey the entire community. And then once they surveyed the community, the process started to go viral, so they would help their neighbours in the nearby towns. They ended up developing the political strategies to go along with it, whether it was targeting certain politicians, you know, the knitting nanas against gas, targeting Thomas George every week at his at his electoral office, or it might have, yeah, I think someone started CSG the musical up there, for instance, which seemed like a crazy idea and not particularly strategic at the time. However, it made something like $20,000 for the community campaign up there.
Wow.
The communities just became alive with this action. And it's exactly the same as what we've seen in Victoria. Initially, a lot of fear. And then actually this process, really bringing people together on the basic values of, you know, maintaining what we have for future generations, caring for the land, caring for each other. And it's had a really transformational effect, I think, in some of these communities having to fight this fight together. So I actually think that it's brought about a lot of positive things.
Yeah.
As much as the destruction that it's brought in places, in other places it's really brought people together, and I think put them in good stead for dealing with the effects of climate change ongoing, which is going to have a massive effect on rural Victoria and bring a lot of difficult situations for these towns. But I think, yeah, actually the fight against unconventional gas has really brought something magical to other places.
You mentioned the community feeling fear about what it is that they could lose. Could you explain in a little bit more detail what the risks are? What is it? What are the things that Victoria could lose? I've heard some pretty terrifying examples of water contamination, not just in Australia but also in the States. Some horror stories. Could you expand on that a little bit?
Sure. Probably I'll just paint a bit of a picture of what has happened in Queensland.
Yeah.
First problematic thing that I can think of is the community division. So a lot of times these companies will come in, they'll find someone who they think is influential in the community, and they'll offer them a quite lucrative access agreement and compensation deal. So the first farmer, they might offer a lot of money, but put under a gag order, saying that he can't say to his neighbours how much he is getting from the company, but he can just tell people that it's a lot. So he might go out and wax lyrical about the industry. Other people might have concerns about it, so they don't sign an access agreement. But the further along you get on the chain, the less and less money they offer you. So a lot of the time we found in these places that the people who've been last to sign access agreements have gotten really bad deals, and they've also felt compelled to sign access agreements because they're suddenly surrounded by these gas fields. They might be having some health problems related to it. They might be just overwhelmed by the industrialisation of their landscape, and suddenly they're kind of trapped in the middle, and they don't get a decent compensation deal because they're the last on the line. So that's created a lot of tension in the community and a lot of division. We've seen huge incidents of bores drying up in Queensland as well, which has had a massive effect on the farmers there. People having various disputes with the companies, which have been ongoing and incredibly stressful for families. We've had families whose kids have gotten sick, who are starting to see a whole heap of symptoms that are similar to the symptoms that people are experiencing gas fields in the United States, but not getting the kind of health monitoring and healthcare that they need. So it starts to paint a pretty scary picture.
I've got to wrap up this interview, but I was just wondering if you could quickly say what you think the future of this campaign will look like, and what your hopes are for the future, and then perhaps where listeners can go if they want to support the campaign.
Sure. So I think that we're very close to a win in Victoria, which is absolutely fantastic, but we really need to put that final push into government. So I encourage people to sign up to updates for the campaign on the Coal and Gas Free Victoria website, which is coalandgasfreevic.org. Sign up for updates there, and get onto the Premier, get onto the Deputy Premier, get onto the Treasurer, and tell them we want Victoria to remain gas field free. These communities are saying they're going to do whatever it takes to stop gas fields. We need to give them certainty, and a ban is the way to do that.
Yeah, so that was coalandgasfreevic.org.
That's it.
Great. Thank you so much for coming into Friends of the Earth today.
Thank you.
Go enjoy your breakfast. If you're just tuning in, you're just tuning in, we're having technical difficulties? No. We're in Friends of the Earth on Smith Street in Collingwood. This is Tuesday breakfast for the annual Sustainable Breakfast series, where all week we're talking about sustainability, and we're also having free breakfast and coffee, so come down between 7 and 8:30 all week. Our theme today was water, and I just spoke to Chloe Aldenholm, who is a anti-coal and gas campaigner from Victorian Lock the Gate campaign and Quit Coal. If you want to visit the website coalandgasfreevic.org, you can learn how to get involved in their campaign and put pressure on Victorian leaders to push the moratorium into being a full-time ban.
Also, big shout out to Friends of the Earth Food Co-op on Smith Street, Collingwood, who have let us be part of the Sustainability Breakfast Series and host here, and for hosting us. And thank you, City of Yarra, for all your support. The gentleman on the mic and who's going to play us some amazing music now is Carol Carpani. Hit it.
Bad habits, cocktails of seven deadly sins will just blow your only child completely away. We know our young kids, they frequent city pubs and clubs, often found inebriated on their dirty floors. Constitutions are failed by that sweet, wicked rainbow juice alcohol. All those $1 shooters at the bar and no cafe room. The water rose that I once drank from were so crystal clear. Just ask the first Australian. We can bloody tell you mate is coming to get you. I'll quench in your chalices, sound your alert. Going young people, hey, rise up now, gather your masses, democracy, gotta defeat that hypocrisy, tell them you know how to tell all their lies. Going young people, hey, the future of this take your generation to cool globalization, cause our world leaders just do not know how. Yeah. Our Father who art in heaven, good, I might tell me Jesus your name.
Was it not you who created a game plan? Put it in reverse or have you damn me all the same like those clowns in Disneyland? Yes, I've walked through your Silicon Valleys of technology, but look at us, we walk as if though we fear nobody, as if though we've got all the power and the glory, forever and ever and ever. Amen. Going heaven. Hey, can you hear me? Our world's in trouble. She's on her knees. We've said our vows. She needs us now. Going heaven. Hey, can you see me? There is pain, hunger, agony. Can you see living on earth is in living for free? Send your disciple. Jesus, God, don't forget to arm them with your Bible. Sanctify.
Been up this early for ages, so if you wonder I'm not looking at you, I might fall asleep if I do. Thank you. This is wonderful. The theme of water. I had an extraordinary conversation down in Tassie with a PhD horticulturist. Said that there's a very low level of current in water, and I reckon there is. I've been working on a film, and I've got a few of my songs on the soundtrack, and I just wrote this brand new title. It's called Motor Kite Dreaming. Adelaide Hughes lads and their wives, they vent, they learn to fly. They announced the flight plan, SAWA, some 4,000 came. Live or die, it's your dream, hit the sky flying high, low, fast and slow. The protocols are all done, suit and helmet comes on, buckled in, revved up, adrenaline pumped up, and you just sing, bring it on, bring it on, bring it on, yeah. Mordecai dreaming, you just say, bring it on, bring it on, bring it on, yeah. Mordecai dreaming.
Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia, on the Kulin Nation. For more information and to find out how you can support 3CR, go to www.3cr.org.au.